Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Gabe Bullard interviews the author of Feel My Humorous. First, recently Barbara Gooding, a junior at Western Hills High School in Frankfort, recited a poem by George Eliot in front of a panel that included writer Garrison Keillor and actress Tyne Daly. Here is Gooding with I Grant You Ample Leave.
My name is Barbara Gooding. I am the 2009 champion from Kentucky. I Grant You Ample Leave by George Eliot. I grant you ample leave, to use the hoary formula. I am naming the emptiness where thought is not, but fill the void with definition. I will be no more a datum than the words you link false inference with. The since and so that true or not make up the atom whirl. Resolve your ego. It is all one web with vibrant ether clotted into worlds. Your subject, self or self-assertive I, turns not but object, melts to molecules, is stripped from naked being with the rest of those rag garments named the universe. Or, if in strife to keep your ego strong, you make it weaver of the ethereal light, space, motion, solids, and the dream of time. Why, still, 'tis being looking from the dark. The core, the center of your consciousness that notes your bubble world. Sense, pleasure, pain. What are they but a shifting otherness? Phantasmal flux of moments.
That recitation of this poem and two others won her second place in Poetry Out Loud, an education project of the National Endowment for the Arts and the Poetry Foundation. She received $10,000 and her school got $500 to purchase poetry books. Gooding's road to the national competition started in January at Western Hills High School in Frankfort. She told WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer how it all started.
It was a grade, first of all. We had to recite a poem. We had to memorize one for our teacher. And then if you won the class competition, if you so chose to take it somewhere, actually work on it, pass memorization, then you went on to the school competition. And from there, if you won the school competition, you went on to state.
And how did you choose your poems for the class project and then for your later competitions?
For class, you had to pick one that was 14 stanzas, at least. Like, it had to be a substantial poem. I just went through the database and read as many as I could, and if the pacing, if they sounded good to me, then I picked it. And when I won the school competition, I had to turn in my poems that very day. So the person who got second, we used his poem, Progressive Health, and then I had to look on the database and decide within an hour, okay, what else sounds good?
And had you read a lot of poetry before this?
Before this, it was primarily nonfiction or prose, mainly for school.
How did you learn to read poems out loud?
For me, it was sitting down, reading it to myself just over and over again. And since the pacing, since the language is most of the time abstract, then you kind of have to make it make sense to yourself. I can't really explain that. I didn't necessarily learn what made sense to me. I just portrayed.
In reading I Grant You Ample Leave by George Eliot, how did you parse that out or decide to parse that out the way that you did?
Getting the idea behind the poem wasn't easy, so my teacher helped me with that. The antiquated language more or less tripped me up. Since it was a short poem, I paused on lines that contained words that, I mean, I needed to rest on, words that I needed to work out in my own head. So the longer I held out a pause or the longer I held out a word was really me portraying, okay, I'm figuring this out for myself. So once I figured out what the poem was actually saying, then it wasn't really portraying what the author had in mind, then it was portraying what I understood of that.
And what did you understand the poem to be about, and what did you learn about the poem in reading it?
It's about how life isn't necessarily a stream of thought. They're just moments after moments, and people are here just to be, not really to be anything specific. We're all kind of caught in our own little world, and that's all we know.
And what did you learn from it for yourself? Just ideas about everyday life.
For myself, well, that everything that I see is my own perception. To not take other people too seriously, because what they say, essentially, I'll never know what they say, what they mean, because I'm stuck in my own head, right? I have my own perceptions of that, and that goes for pretty much everything, not just human relations.
Did you have that kind of idea or that perception, I guess, before?
No, actually, I could pretty much say that I was invested in not necessarily what other people thought, but what they meant. And other people's meanings will be a mystery, but I can only portray what I know, and that's all it is what I know.
In reading that poem and the others, did you read a lot of other work by the same authors?
I tried. I was actually more engrossed in the longer poems. My teacher picked up a book, like an anthology of her work, and I've read longer poems by her. I can't remember the names, but they tend to tell a story, and they tend to reveal her own views on feminism, which is very much like this poem. If you take gender out of the equation, it's more or less that one person's physical, their own essence in this world, and how it's a mystery in of itself, so you really can't tack gender onto it.
Regarding the other poems, what other poems did you read and how did you choose them?
I read Kissing Stieglitz Goodbye by Gerald Stern and Progressive Health by Carl Dennis. How I chose them was, for the first one, Kissing Stieglitz Goodbye, it was mainly what interested me were the images in it. It mentioned Georgia O'Keeffe and Alfred Stieglitz and how he overlaps their accomplishments, their works, and his own thought processes together. It kind of balances out the George Eliot poem in a way that it almost proves that everything is so overlapped and you don't really know how to decipher any of it, but that it's this huge thing that you can't quite grasp and you can't get away from. And the other one, Progressive Health by Carl Dennis, pretty much chosen at last minute. And that one's essentially saying, you're worthless, but you're practical. You know you're worthless.
So all of these were really about your identity and how you perceive it in the world vis-a-vis other people.
Yeah, your identity and, more thought-provoking and emotional, your worth. What is your worth as a human being?
And what was it like to compete using these poems at the national level of Poetry Out Loud in Washington, D.C.?
I wasn't doing a poem that was based around someone else's experience. There are some concerning death, there are some concerning, you know, and sex, and I didn't really have an experience, someone else's experience to go on. It allowed me to be more confident because it allowed me to, in essence, question the audience's worth, which is really empowering and kind of funny.
And what was it like seeing these students from all over the United States and hearing them recite poetry that you had studied or looked over and read in preparing for this contest?
It ranged from entertainment to a little annoying, actually, because when I've read a poem and I like it, I have expectations for that poem automatically. But at the same time, it was almost like Christmas because, you know, at the state competition, I mean, I expected them to be better than the competition I had already saw, so it was kind of entertaining to equate myself to really, really smart kids. They were great kids, and it was entertaining. It wasn't really a competition in that respect. It was, you know, we've all worked hard, and now we can show each other what we've done.
And what was it like when you found out that you had come in second place and what the prizes were?
It was bittersweet, actually. $10,000, well, I mean, definitely, I was happy about that, but there's just something about winning second, you know, like it's not that I went into this competition in mind, like, you know, okay, I'm going to win and I'm going to beat all these people. It was, you know, more or less, you know, I didn't want second. I mean, I wanted to win, but it was good because placing in a national competition, I have to realize that, you know, well, second in the nation is not exactly bad.
Mm-hmm. Will you try again next year?
No. I'm actually kind of against people coming back more than 1 year because I think once you already go once, you need to give someone else a try, because then by going again, you're only making it a competition. You're taking out the learning aspect. And the whole point of the program was just to get poetry to as many people as possible, because the point of the recitation is to, for these kids, is to help them understand and expand their knowledge of poetry.
And how has this experience and this deep analysis of poetry shaped your view of literature?
In writing in class, I've actually become more precise, and, well, at least I try to be. And for literature, it's made me realize how dense a larger work could be, because poetry in itself, it's short and it's very condensed in one spot, so you really do have to spend time on that. But with this, it's given me a background as to look into the lyrical aspect of novels, even of essays, why certain words go together, why people remember those combinations, and what makes them so endearing, and why we hold those so high.
What kind of advice would you give any students that are participating next year?
That you are not acting this poem, and it's not a monologue. It is a piece of literature, and you need to read it as such. When you read it, don't take the words for face value. If they imply something, show what it implies. Don't show what it literally says.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
There's more information on Poetry Out Loud at our website, wfpl.org. A book of Kentucky-oriented humor is reaching store shelves this month. It's written and put there by Don Ray Smith. The humorist has self-published a book of essays, articles, columns, and poems. It's called Feel My Humorous. That's humorous as in the bone in the upper arm. Gabe Bullard sat down with Smith to talk about comedy, writing, and the perks of self-publication.
Your book, it's called Feel My Humorous, and it's a collection of humor writings, some published in Louisville Magazine, various newspapers, also on your website.
Right.
And so how did you come to get this collection?
Well, actually, it's one of those things where you end up with a book and you don't realize you're working on a book. I had actually accumulated all these articles over probably 9 or 10 years of writing for those different publications and doing radio commentaries and so on. And as it happened, I started putting them together in order to enter a book contest. And I did not win the book writing contest, but it gave me a great momentum and a great goal to shoot for. It gave me a deadline and so on. And although I did not win that, I looked down and said, hey, I've still got a book.
What got you started in humor writing?
Well, that goes all the way back, Gabe, to the newspaper columnist of old. People like Mike Royko, Art Buchwald, Russell Baker, those people were just fabulous in my eyes back when I was growing up in high school.
And so did you start writing in high school, writing the humor?
Actually, not too long after that. I actually started writing humor columns in college when the editor of the college paper sort of walked around and said, can you write anything? You know, one of those things. We have a space about 4x5 to fill in the paper. So I ended up being a quote humor columnist in both of the college newspapers that represented the colleges I went to in those days.
And reading some of these pieces, specifically in the shorter fiction section, shorter humor section, there are some there's some commentary too. There's some insights into race relations, into just kind of culture in general. And is that something you see as the best way to address through humor? Or is that just your style of approaching these topics?
Yeah, that's the only way I know how to deal with that. Hit people over the head with a hammer all day when it comes to race relations, and that's the wonderful, quick way to turn people off. So I just decided to try to go in the side door and, you know, let whatever statements I had to make sort of drift in on people.
Do you start in with the idea of having a message for the column, or were you starting in with the idea of first writing something funny and then adding the message to it later?
Well, I've always wanted to express myself with humor in one way or another. And like I say, those great columnists and great writers of old, Woody Allen and so on, they always had something to say. Groucho Marx, they always had something to say beyond the joke. So that's what really attracted me.
So it's you think of what to say and then approach it with the joke.
Yeah, and there's always a core idea, a theme, a core idea, a point of view, etc., which I put in place in my mind and pretty much try to turn it on its ear and say, how can I make this funny so people can actually pay attention to what I'm saying instead of throwing it in the garbage?
And later on, did you gather new influences as you continued writing?
Comics I've always liked. Like I say, Woody Allen was big, Steve Martin, although he's a little bit more broad as far as how much weight his humor carried. You know, you stick an arrow through your head, how deep is that, other than about 8 inches? But, you know, other than that, contemporaries here and there, but basically I go back to the great humorist as far back as Thurber and Benchley even, and just carry the whole thing forward. Wherever I can find Molly Ivins, whoever I can find somebody who has something to say and say it with a sense of humor, that's what really pulls me in.
The comics you mentioned, Steve Martin and Woody Allen, have both written essays in the past. Are you influenced, would you say, more by their essay writing or more by their performances?
I would say, Steve Martin was just a fantastic performance type of comedy deliverer anyway. Woody Allen, on the other hand, was so cerebral that you could just sit there with an essay of his and just go over it two or three times and really appreciate the deeper messages he was sending out. So Woody Allen, cerebral, Steve Martin, more off-the-wall stuff.
What about the local voice of Kentucky? Do you see the fact that you're in Kentucky as something that's going to show in your work?
Hopefully so, because after I left college, I graduated from Western Kentucky. And after I left, my first job was in a newspaper, on a newspaper up in Ohio. And from that point, I did a lot of traveling, covered a lot of cities and so on. But I came home and Kentucky and Louisville in general, don't have a lot of local or regional humorist voices. So, you know, I'm trying to be universal and at the same time tag some of my stuff to local reference points.
What do you think goes into the Louisville voice as far as humor? You being one of the main purveyors of it, what helps make that either the Kentucky voice or the Louisville voice?
I think Louisville is just, even from a geographic standpoint, is just really a kind of a different city, because you got this built-in identity crisis. Are we in the farthermost northern city? Are we the southernmost southern city? Are we the easternmost western city? Et cetera, et cetera. Just where does a Louisvillian put himself or herself geographically, for starters? And then creatively, well, you've got a lot of viewpoints in this part of the country, which you can actually blend, like I say, geographically, for starters, you can blend with other pieces from other parts of the country.
So it's not so much an extension of the Southern tradition as a boiling pot or a melting pot of kind of all the regions nearby.
Yeah, you know, Louisville is just positioned in a way that almost induces one to think sometimes as a northerner, simply because we got such an influx of workers from the north in the technologies, for instance. At the same time, you know, we just celebrated Derby, in which you are supposed to paint yourself as southern as possible if you live here. So you've got different influences to work with there.
How did you come about to publish the book, as far as actually collecting these stories, these essays, and even poems, and putting them into the book?
Well, I actually did some research, which told me, talked to people in the business, I talked to publishers, I read, I called people who freelance and one-man shops, publishing houses, and so on, did a lot of research. And one of the bottom lines, Gabe, is that you have to promote yourself and you have to market yourself if you are under a publishing house, or if you're like Don Ray Smith and is a standalone. Nevertheless, you have to publish yourself. It's on your shoulders to market yourself, publish yourself, let people know you're out there, and make yourself available for readings or book signings or whatever. So being slow, it finally dawned on me, why don't I just do this myself?
When we come back, Robin Fisher talks with Louisville native Dwight Allen about his latest novel. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Elizabeth Kramer talks with members of Pandora Productions about two plays this month. First, sometimes it's the stories of everyday, ordinary people that affect us the most. Louisville native Dwight Allen's latest novel, The Typewriter Satyr, is one of those stories. With characters as familiar as your next-door neighbors, Allen creates a world that's both comforting and unsettling. Robin Fisher spoke with Allen about his latest novel, how characters develop, and what it means to have a sense of place.
I kind of want to start with a big question. I want to ask you, what do you think the book is about?
I guess I tend not to think in those terms when I'm writing a book. Sometimes I'm sort of forced to after it's all done. I don't think about the abouts or the whatever it is. I don't write fiction to make a point or to say something. Anyways, I don't set out to do that. So it's, you know, generally it's my hope that a reader will find in my novels, you know, characters who are as complex as themselves, and prose that, at least from time to time, could be said to have a certain formal rigor or beauty. So when I think about the book, I just think about its characters, and its two main ones are a typewriter repairman who's in his mid-50s, who's married with four children, and the other main character is a 30-something woman who works as a disc jockey, late-night disc jockey, at sort of a fringe radio station or a community radio station in a town in Wisconsin called Midvale in my book. The book is about their relationship and sort of the collision of their two different worlds and the consequences of their relationship, which are both, comic and disastrous. I'm not sure which takes precedence, but
I would say that it is a quiet book. And the way that I mean that is that it seemed to seemed to unfold slowly, but not slowly as in a bad way. It just seemed to sort of unfold one layer at a time without ever thinking as a reader, where is this book going? Mm-hmm. You know, it is so character-driven that you just want to sort of live with those characters.
Right. Yeah. You know, when I start writing either a story or a novel, I don't often know where I'm going. I usually don't know where I'm going until I get to the end of it, and then I sort of have to back up and not exactly start over again, hopefully, but at least revise in large ways sometimes. I tend to follow wherever it is my characters lead me. You know, sometimes they lead me into dark holes that I can't get out of, but generally I try to figure out what it is they want. That can take you to interesting places, I think.
Well, you know, that leads me to another question that I had. I was curious about the genesis of the book, because I can see how the book might have started with a sketch of just about any one of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, you know, everything develops around that character. Is that how it started? Did it start with Oliver, or maybe it started with Diane, or?
I would say it started with Oliver. I mean, I actually had a typewriter. I didn't really use it very much at the time I started the novel, but I took it in for repairs. I guess I just used it to type envelopes. I took it in for repairs. There's actually, or were then, still two typewriter repair shops in Madison. The idea for Oliver just came from somebody doing a job like typewriter repair, which is, to say the least, a kind of niche business or fringe business. I think that's where the novel started. Certain issues in my own life became, you know, part of what I was writing about as well. But the main impetus, I think, was this character, Oliver, and his peculiar job.
In the novel, the town of Midvale, to me, is its own character.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's sort of like a big, small town, whereas everyone's sort of on the fringe of knowing everyone else.
Right.
And I sort of saw Wade as the thread, Wade, the homeless character, mm-hmm. as the thread that runs through sort of the whole novel, because he is in every part of town.
Yeah, he does get around a lot. Pretty mobile with his grocery cart. He is kind of that. You know, he does connect one character to another in odd ways. And this town is kind of small townish in some ways. I mean, it's obviously it's based on Madison, which is a town of 200,000 and is, you know, a fairly liberal-minded kind of place. It diverges from Madison, too, in significant ways. I mean, I did my best to avoid putting in any geographical details that would say it was Madison. I mean, the town council in Midvale is dominated by Republicans, and that just doesn't happen around here. And the figure on top of the courthouse in Midvale is a sort of seedy fur trapper who's sort of the essence of you know, the politically incorrect Mr. Backwards. And whereas in Madison, the main square where the farmers market is held every Saturday is dominated by the Capitol, and on top of the Capitol there's this a sort of mythical woman who's known as Miss Forward, because Forward is Wisconsin's motto. So she has a little, a raccoon, or no, not a raccoon, I'm sorry, a badger, and a couple of ears of corn on top of her head. But anyways, I didn't want to be obligated by, you know, journalistic concerns or having to I think one of the freedoms for me of writing fiction is that you're not required to be a journalist. You can go where you want to go, and you can have things happen in your cities that, you know, don't happen in actual life.
You know, I thought it was interesting. I did think of Madison as I was reading the novel, because I knew that Midvale was not Madison, but somehow loosely based on that. But I read several stories from The Green Suit, your first book, and a lot of that is set here.
Right.
And your connection to place, I think, is very interesting in the way it comes out in your writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's very organic.
Uh-huh.
And I found that in this novel as well, as I had found it in The Green Suit, only not, the place is not quite as identifiable as I felt some of them in The Green Suit. I felt like I was in that neighborhood.
Right.
It's like I know that neighborhood.
Yeah, in The Green Suit, I mean, I called Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking about place the other day. I mean, I'm going up to this book festival in Appleton, Wisconsin, which is where Lawrence University is, where I went to college. And I'm sitting on this panel with this other guy who's a writer from Milwaukee, and we're supposed to talk about being a Wisconsin writer. And I've lived here for, I guess, about 18 years now, not counting the 4 years that I lived in, went to college at Lawrence. And I haven't lived in Louisville since I left for college, and I finally lived there for my first 18 years. And then I lived in New York for another 15 years. So I was recalling it back in 2003, I think it was, when my second book came out. I went to this book festival in Nashville. I forget what the name of the festival is, but it's a big Southern book festival. And I did this reading, joint reading with a guy named Silas House,
mm-hmm.
Who's from the mountains of Eastern Kentucky, and whose books I think could be said to have a definite regional slant. During the Q&A, somebody asked Silas about the sense of place in his writing, and he sort of wound up his speech by saying something like, I'm not sure this is a verbatim quote, but I'm damn proud to be a Southerner. This remark sort of elicited, the kind of war whoops that you get at political rallies. And then I got asked a similar question about what I was, regionally speaking, and I sort of mumbled something about being neither this nor that, and sort of part lapsed Southerner and part transplanted Yankee, and part just, lost sheep or something. And the truth was, though, I sort of felt kind of like a Martian when I was under that tent with Silas. Place in my fiction is, I've always sort of felt a need to write about places where I have lived, and rather than some writers seem to find it easy to invent things about places where they haven't been, and a lot of them do it very convincingly, but I haven't felt that kind of urge as a writer.
And particularly with this novel, it lent a sense of realism. I felt like these people are people that I see every day.
Mm-hmm.
And not as in this character Oliver is just like someone I would see on the street, but that there is an Oliver everywhere.
Right.
You know, or there's an Annalise everywhere. And even in the supporting characters, in an odd way, when I was reading this book, I thought of the writer Julia Glass.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, she has a lot of, several of her novels, her tangential characters have become main characters in other novels. And I could see that in this particular, with this particular group of characters. And I wondered if you thought any of these characters will live on, or do you not know that until you sit down to write?
I guess I don't. I won't know that until I sit down to write, though I have thought from time to time that I should have done more with Wade, the homeless man, throughout the novel. And maybe even dropped one of the subsidiary characters who I just didn't do enough with. But yeah, I mean, sometimes you know, those minor characters do suggest lives that you can write about, but within, you know, the context of a particular novel, their lives sort of have to be more circumscribed. By necessity, I guess. I did at one point think of trying to write again about the sort of the main character of the green suit, Peter Sackrider, and I didn't get anywhere. I haven't, other than that one failed attempt at doing that, I really haven't tried doing it very much. Trying to write about characters who are in novels and seeing it.
Well, maybe you just never know. Maybe,
yep.
Maybe Ham will call out for his own book someday.
Yeah.
That was Robin Fisher talking with author Dwight Allen about his latest novel, The Typewriter Satyr. Allen will read from his book at Carmichael's Bookstore on Frankfort Avenue Tuesday evening at 7. Visit our website for more details, wfpl.org. When we come back, two plays from Pandora Productions are on the stage this month. Elizabeth Kramer has details. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. This month, Pandora Productions brings two Tony Award-winning plays to the stage that are stories of survival. Bent garnered an award for Best Play in 1980, and I Am My Own Wife, a one-man show, took the Tony for Best Play and the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 2004. Elizabeth Kramer talked with actor Roger Fristo, who plays a man who survived the Nazi and communist regimes in East Berlin as a transvestite, and Pandora Productions artistic director Michael Drury.
Why did you choose to run Bent and I Am My Own Wife in alternating repertory to end the season?
I wanted to revive our production of Bent because it was one of my favorite productions that we've done. And we did it before we had a large following. So I wanted to bring that to the broader audience that we've built over the last 5 years. I also thought that because there were some of our patrons who had seen it before, it probably wouldn't merit a full run. And I was also concerned programming I Am My Own Wife because it is a one-man show. And while it's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, and since it had run in Louisville before, I thought it would be better paired with something else.
First, a little bit about the story of Bent.
The story follows Max, who is the main character, and his partner Rudy when we first meet them. And Max is quite the playboy in the gay scene in Berlin. And I think it's important to know that in Berlin, prior to the Night of the Long Knives, being gay was pretty accepted. There was talk of legalizing homosexuality in Berlin at that time in 1933. So it was pretty free and easy. And so Max lived that lifestyle. And it follows his story. And he, on the Night of the Long Knives, brings home a trick from the bar, who just happens to be part of the Nazi youth. The Nazis storm the apartment the next morning to look for this guy and sets the play in motion. So then Max and Rudy are on the run and eventually find themselves rather captured. I don't want to go much farther than that because it would give a lot of information away.
And how do the plays go together thematically?
Bent takes place during the Holocaust, at the beginning of the Holocaust, right after Ernst Röhm was killed on the Night of the Long Knives, which sort of really started a lot of the war in motion before the rest of the world. And the beginning of I Am My Own Wife, or at least it doesn't follow a linear path, does it, Roger?
No, not really.
But it starts before that period and encompasses that period and then goes on even farther than that. So thematically, they're very similar. Charlotta in I Am My Own Wife deals with much of the same thing and avoids Nazi capture, and from her intuition and slickness, I guess. She's very smart.
There's a kind of common theme of survival.
Yes.
How do you get through this?
And one of the themes that I love the most is that all of these characters in this tumultuous time do experience love, particularly in Bent and more subtly, Charlotta even, in I Am My Own Wife.
Bent has had several revival productions this year. And I realize that part of it is because it's the 30-year anniversary of its premiere. But what are some other reasons that you see makes it withstand the test of time?
It does cover universal themes of love and survival, and it fulfills our mission in that it tells a story that I don't think a lot of our community knows. And by community, I mean the GLBT community. You know, we use the pink triangle as a symbol of pride, but I'm not sure that our community knows where that symbol came from.
And can you explain that?
Yes. In the Holocaust, the Jewish people were given a yellow star for their prison uniforms. And even before they went to the concentration camps, they had to wear yellow stars on their clothing. And in the concentration camps, people were labeled with different color emblems depending on how they came to be in the concentration camp. And gay men were given pink triangles. Lesbians were given black triangles. And it is that time that gave us that symbol and also is a symbol of pride.
And Roger, what does I Am My Own Wife teach us about that time and how we see it now?
I think it's the idea of survival and how each individual person has to approach that. In the case of the leading character in I Am My Own Wife, she's such an eccentric transvestite and is more devoted to her collection of furniture than anything else in the world. And she was brave enough and courageous enough to not stand down from any of this and to survive in her own way. And she's very defiant with both the Nazis and then later with the communists about, this is who I am, this is how I'm going to live my life, and I'm not going to let you stop me from doing it. So I think in her case, it's this idea of a strong feeling as an individual. I am myself. I will go on, and you will not stop me.
How did you come to find a connection to this play? I know that in 2007, you performed it at the Clarksville Theater, the drama studio, and the play premiered in 2003, so it's a fairly new play.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me how you came to find this play and start to really delve into it as an actor?
It was my first director, Deborah Rice Endress, at the drama studio, who thought of it for me, and I would never have read the description of this play and said, ah, that's the thing for me. So I was quite surprised when she proposed it, and then I started working on it and reading it and over and thinking about it. And I became so fascinated by it. And I actually went to Malsdorf in East Germany, where Charlotta lived. And so I was able to see her museum and those pieces of furniture that were so important to her, and to listen to her old recordings. That was another thing that she was so devoted to. We're preserving the old recordings and the old phonographs and gramophones. And I could listen to those recordings that she loved so much there in the house where she had listened to them. I could see the bed she slept in. So I was able to make a more personal connection with the character by being there and kind of absorbing that atmosphere, I think.
And Charlotta was a real person.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
What was her story?
Well, from the time she was a child, she had felt in her soul that she was a woman. She had no interest in making any physical changes to her body, but she wanted to live her life as a woman. If she'd been allowed to live as she wanted, she probably would have had a sweet little home somewhere in the suburbs and kept her furniture and had a husband who came home in the evenings and that type of thing, that would have been heaven for her. But she wasn't allowed to do that, so she had to make her own adjustments and to live her life as best she could and live up to her own ideals of what she should be.
And in the play, you play more than one character. It's actually a couple dozen or more.
Yeah, it's 30-something. Some are very small. Some just pop in and out. I'd say there are 6 or 7 who are really important main characters. The others are quickly in and out of the action.
And how do you prepare for that? How did you prepare the first time and then revisiting it now after having that experience and some time to kind of reflect on the character and the different other characters? Mm-hmm. How do you approach it this time with a new director being Rand Harmon?
Well, that's made it interesting because Rand had never seen a production of the play, let alone the one I was in. So he came to it entirely fresh, and he saw rhythms in the play that weren't necessarily the way I had seen them the first time, emphasis and stress on different characters in different situations. So it was very stimulating to me to get a fresh approach, and I didn't see any point really in doing it again exactly the way I'd done it before, so I was happy and welcomed these changes.
And Michael, this is the second time around for you with Bent.
Mm-hmm.
How did you approach the play 5 years ago, and how has that changed this time around?
I thought that our production 5 years ago was really wonderful. It's one of my favorite theater memories. Phil Howell is back playing Max, and the both of us, I think, have matured a lot and come back at it with a different eye a bit. And he has certainly matured into the role, and I'm really stunned at some of the work that he's doing. His companion in Act Two is played by a different actor, and that brings a different dynamic this time. In approaching it differently, I didn't approach it very differently. We've blocked it a little bit differently because we're in a different space this time. Another challenge this time is doing the show in rep with another show, because this show has quite a lot of scene changes and requires a concentration camp fence in Act Two. And I don't want to give any sort of technical secrets away, but we used that element in both productions.
Regarding both productions, what do you think that each of these plays tell us about homosexuality in the world, not only during World War II Germany, but today?
If you compared Berlin before the Holocaust, I think that we're coming around to that again. You know, it seems more accepted. But at the same time, while Roger was talking about Charlotta living her life as she wanted to, I'm really sort of stunned at her courage to do that at that time. And even afterward, you know, going on national television and mm-hmm. just being, you know, being interviewed, and she was quite famous or infamous, I don't know which. and I think of transvestites today, you know, it seems like they're coming out into the light more. But I still think, you know, for her, I think she's, in a way, more courageous than some today feel they can be. And to me, that's sad. So I guess to answer your question, I don't know that a whole lot has changed. And one of the reasons why I get up and do what I do every day for the mission of Pandora.
Did you have anything to add?
Part of Charlotta's defense mechanism was being absolutely adorable. She's like everybody's favorite grandmother, and she can charm people, and that was one of her wiles to get through. I mean, it's very conscious, and so she wasn't really Joan of Arc or anything. You know, she was a little lady down the street who just happened to be a man, and I think she got away with a lot mm-hmm. by playing on that persona.
She was kind of a novelty, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Hellett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.